Les colloques du Collège de France.
I'm not a philosopher and I'm not an international lawyer, either of a public or private variety. And many parts of the paper that I wrote have already been gone over. So I thought I would just talk about the bits of my paper that we haven't talked about yet. So I'm going to begin by talking about property rights, just to show that property philosophically can't be purely unilateral. There has to be a justifying narrative. And then to move to what the justifying narrative, I think, might be. And in that context, my paper talks about three. One is science, which we haven't really talked about as much as I thought we would. And the second is a kind of redistribution, which we have talked a little bit about. And the third is environmental, and here it's a kind of, space and the deep seabed as helping to a green transition. This is a kind of a legitimating narrative. So I'll talk about all three of those. But first, I want to just give a kind of background about property rights to motivate the idea that we need to have a kind of general benefit argument. So there's two ways to think about property rights. And the first way is to think that you have a jurisdictional authority that establishes rules according to which we live. And these rules are rules about the acquisition of property, the transfer of property, taxation of property. And this is the most common and accepted view about property rights. So you can deserve something, but you don't deserve it in a fundamental way. You just deserve it under the rules, whatever the piece of property is or the remuneration. And so this is the dominant view. But in space, we don't have a jurisdictional authority. So we're relying on another view, an older view, which is, maybe it's not older, I think they're both pretty common. We have the view, I think, that space is either commonly owned, in some sense everybody does, or that it's unowned. Actually, the unowned part, the idea that space is unowned, is partly motivates this idea that that you can have unilateral action in space, which requires no consideration for other people. I think this is wrong. But I think it also motivates some of the arguments. I think we heard pieces of this yesterday, especially amongst the private. So this view is an extremely libertarian view, sort of associated with Murray Rothbard, which means that if you have a liberty right to something, you just take it. And this is what Anna Stilts talked about yesterday as the first come, first serve principle. But it's a very strange principle. But it's a very strange principle in the sense that it disregards the interests of other people, and or any consideration of other people in the acquisition of a property right. And that's that would be a strange move for us to make, because if I have a liberty right to take an apple and you have a liberty right to take an apple, then we might view us as having these liberty rights to take something and make it our own. And certainly with use rights, we need to consume resources. But the idea that we do so without any consideration for others, I think is a deep problem, because it's unclear. I can't really fully make this argument here, but it's unclear how a right that's so thin that I could take something and extinguish your right unilaterally cannot be the basis of full liberal property rights. If you're trying to have an account of full liberal property rights, which includes a right to exclude, you have to have a basis that's powerful enough to support that. And a basis which allows for unilateral action that can extinguish your liberty right doesn't seem like that kind of basis. And that's why Locke and others said, well, you have to show some benefit, right? There has to be provisos, there has to be limits on appropriation. It can't be without any consideration for others. So I think that that's that even that if we were to go with that way, it would at least have to have some version of a common benefit argument. So that's my philosophical motivation for why you actually have to show that our interaction with space, and especially to gain any property rights there, there has to be justifying narratives. And there are justifying narratives. And the treaties, they all support, although there's claims about property rights, there's all these background justifying narratives. So I want to talk about those. So one of the justifying narratives is science. This is a nice segue here. And actually, the reference to science and the scientific discovery and scientific exploration to justify our relationship, the proposal with space, is actually in all the treaties. There's quite prominent prominent articles about retaining these for scientific discovery. And so just as a kind of, but even though the articles might even have very similar formulations, if you think about how science is conducted in these places, I mean, it's quite different. So for example, in Antarctica, science was extremely important. And in fact, in order to become a consultative member to the Antarctic Treaty, it was necessary for countries to have scientific missions. And this is just a slightly of an aside, okay? But so there's this really interesting book that talks about these scientific missions, and it was pretty clear that they were somewhat performative, in the sense that different countries, in order to have that status under the Antarctic Treaty, would set up these missions where they would measure the ice flows and they'd measure animals get data about bird, marine, and animal populations. So in some sense, this one common criticism of this was that it was exclusionary, that there were this permanent structure, permanent treaty members, and then there were people who could afford to have scientific missions. But there you have to really temper it, because these missions weren't very expensive. It wasn't very difficult for developing countries to, there is a neocolonial structure here, and it was somewhat exclusionary, but it wasn't very difficult for poor countries to foot the bill for a scientist. And every country doing kind of the same science anyway. So, and in the end, the main critic of the Antarctic Treaty, which is Malaysia, joined it, actually, as a consultative party. And although it was performative, the data in Antarctica, which was almost entirely, mostly collected in order to become a party to the treaty, has been used, has been very important to track anthropogenic climate change. That wasn't like mainly the motive, but it has been. Okay, so that's how it occurred in Antarctica. But the situation in space, even though the treaty articles are the same, is quite different. So if we're going to justify in some way our usufruct property rights in and over celestial bodies in part, and this relationship by appeal to science, it might be useful to think sociologically about how the scientific endeavor takes place and whether it contributes to human well-being. So at one level, we all, I think everybody in this room, thinks that science is a good thing. This is a really common, if we believe in the intrinsic value of human knowledge, knowledge for knowledge's sake, or the scientific endeavor, we sort of accept that general appeal to science. And it has a very strong resonance in our culture, too, if you think about science. If you think about, like, the original Star Trek series always began as if the fundamental mission of the Enterprise was to boldly go where no person has gone before for scientific discovery. So this is a very powerful idea. But then we have to put it in its sociological context. And the clear difficulty here is that outer space research is so enormously expensive that it is conducted almost entirely through a mix of public and private partnerships. And now I just want to talk about a worry that we should have, I have, about with these private space companies, which are often also not only private space companies, but because of satellites, they're also cyberspace companies. And the distinct worries about the inequality engendered and the deep power asymmetry. So I'll just talk about that just briefly, even though it's neither international law or really philosophy. So Boeing is the second largest aerospace company in the world, Airbus. It has contracts to build communication satellites wideband for the US Space Force's Space System Command, and contracts to provide secure communication to the US military using a system integrated with their satellite. This is true of almost all other satellite companies, which are private businesses, which has contracts with the public sector, typically offering services to the state, including border security and military telecommunication. So other space-based companies include France's Eutelsat, which has a fleet of satellites operating across Europe, Israel's Gilat, Satellite Globalstar Incorporated also, Lockheed Martin Corporation, Elon Musk SpaceX, Northrop Grumman, EchoStar, the Boeing Company, Airbus Defense and Space, each one of which in the worth in the billions of US dollars, and of satellites that enable communication, GPS, detection, reporting of threats in space, both for private commercial purposes and for the states that they operate in. Obviously, there's rocket companies too. There's large private but nonprofit companies such as the Aerospace Corporation, whose activities are inextricably connected to the state. That's a federally funded private but nonprofit corporation that works in cooperation with NASA to design infrastructure aimed at responding to domain threats in real time before spacecraft, satellites, other space missions, and space systems are actually threatened. So we have this, and I could go on about there's contracts with rocket ships, with setting up space. So we have this interconnected relationship between public and private in the state. So the way in which science is conducted, the contracts for scientific discovery by the state in relation to many of these threats or state goals seems to me like a problem. Now, somebody might say to me, in fact, I think people would say to me, well, isn't the problem, Margaret, just like capitalism, and you're just complaining about capitalism? And in one sense, I think this is right. I'm not making a Marxist argument, because Marx thought that the state was biased in all cases toward the class that controls the means of production and not just in capitalism. And he thought that the structure of capitalism and the incentives generated by capitalism make it the case that the government officials will not pursue justice or the common good. What I'm saying, so I'm a social democrat, I'm saying that the state's role is to regulate capitalism. Okay, that's what the state's role is here. And what we have is an interaction between public and private, and in the domain of space in particular, which makes it worrying that the state isn't actually able to effectively discharge its function to regulate capitalism. And I think that we have to think about that. We have to worry about the domain of space with regard to two tendencies. And the first is its contribution to inequality, which I want to talk about. And the second is the undermining of the state as our central regulator for capitalism. So I'm just going to talk about those a little bit before I briefly mention the other two benefits kinds of arguments. So in Capitalism in the 21st Century, Thomas Piketty examines modern-day capitalism's, and so this is an aside, this will come right back to space, okay? But I'm going to just give you the picture. So Piketty argues that the post-war period, when inequality started to narrow, is itself an aberration, and marshals massive social science data to show this. And it was a confluence of several different factors. But before that time, throughout the 19th century, and after the post-war period, including now and looks like into the future, foreseeable future, capitalism has a general tendency to greater inequality. So Piketty's explanation for this empirical tendency is connected to the division of profits between capital and labor. And especially in periods of low economic growth, tend to be biased towards rewarding capital. Actually, this wouldn't be a problem if capital was generally dispersed, if we had a more equal society, because you can reward capital and then it could go to more people. But it is a problem in an unequal society where capital is in a small number of hands because it contributes to even greater inequality. And that is combined in present times with the rise of a small, influential, handsomely rewarded managerial class in large corporations, cyberspace corporations, space companies, and the financial sector, which supercharges large inequalities. And Piketty also describes this small elite of super managers as operating within this general inequality generated by the relationship between capital and labor, where they deploy the discourse of merit to seek and reward themselves and convince societies that they merit very large rewards and cannot be justified by any theory of marginal contribution to productivity. And in fact, there's an observable interaction between this class of workers and the tax systems in almost all Western economies, which consistently have lowered the marginal tax rate on very high incomes, so further supercharging this, sort of motivating this class of highly remunerated managers to seek even greater rewards. So that's the main engine of growing inequality, and it's hard to see how this inequality can narrow, okay? And that is a problem for democracy, that this growing inequality is a problem for social justice and for general human being. And while it is not a unique feature of the domain of space, this is a kind of general problem, it's a problem there because A, this sphere is dominated by large multi-billion dollar companies. B, it's an area of the economy with very high capital barriers to entry. And C, where the rewards for like the super manager class, for investors, for people getting these big grants from the government are already staggeringly high. So space research, space research sounds good and science sounds good, but as space research is conducted, it looks like it will exacerbate the general problem of increased inequality and its concomitant pathologies, because it's operating with technology and for profits, and the technologies are technologies that we do not and cannot have access to. And then the second kind of problem, which is kind of, is that this close relationship between public and private also threatens one of the key functions of the state, that is, its role in regulating capital or the private sector. And so I've sort of discussed this already about the close connection between the state, often the military, and space companies has been well documented, although it's not confined to space companies. Actually, cyberspace companies are big too. So to give an idea of the concern here, consider SpaceX, which works closely with the Pentagon, NASA, and other space agencies, which makes it a key player in United States national security. In 2020, federal contracts made up almost 84% of the rocket company's total revenue. And due to a tax loophole introduced under the first Trump administration, the multi-billion dollar company pays little or no taxes during a period where Mr. Musk, the founder and owner of SpaceX, has posted on social media that company's commercial revenue from space will exceed the entire budget of NASA next year. So the worry here is that when we think about science and scientific discovery, I think we're not thinking about the ways in which this is conducted by space companies who are at the forefront of space research. And the relationship between those companies and the states makes it difficult, I think, for the state's regulatory role to be discharged properly. When I thought this, it was during a period where Musk was dismantling the federal government, and I thought, well, there was personal connections. But I want to argue here that it's a kind of structural dependence of the state on such companies and the power of the state vis-a-vis these very powerful and rich companies, which have a key role in our communications, cyber technology, their satellites, business, defense, and security. So I'm not suggesting that the science itself is harmful, although it may be. It's a narrower one that it's not organized, that the main agents of scientific discovery are private companies that are engaged in profit. So that's worry one about the benefits argument. So this scientific discovery as a legitimating narrative, I think, at least has to be situated in a sociological context. And then I think that there's two other sorts of arguments that we could make for general benefit. And I think that each one of these arguments also is a problem. So one argument is simply that the proceeds from, let's say, space mining or space activities could be subject to redistribution. This actually fits in really well with your talk. But So this is, so this idea of general benefit has been, so I have a discussion about the idea of general benefit for the seabed and in the case of space mining. And it's actually noteworthy that at least in the ISA, the pro-mining Secretary General of the ISA from 2017 to 2024, although I understand that it's different now, did endorse the principle of equitable benefit, but whether or not this would lead to any kind of straightforward redistribution seemed to be very doubtful, because he also cautioned that it would take years for redistribution to come on stream, since this capital costs of seabed mining were very high, so there would be no surplus available for redistribution for a long time to come. In the case of the proceeds of the sale of space, I mean, I do think that has the potential to render resource extraction of these space activities in the general interest of humankind. But it's noteworthy that there's no general mechanism for this redistribution. There's no international agency that could be assigned this task, unlike the seabed. In fact, if the idea is, as under the Artemis Accord, that each territorial state has regulate space activities, then each territorial state has different policies vis-a-vis taxation, as well as different rules and legislation governing the different companies, which almost guarantees that the main, that the redistribution will not be to the global poor, who would be the obvious group that such redistribution could be directed to. And even with respect to national redistribution, as I've discussed above, and looking only at SpaceX, space companies are taxed even less than terrestrial companies. So what about the argument? So that's argument two, like the redistribution argument. I mean, it's not that it isn't a good argument, it's just that it's unlikely to happen. And the third argument is, well, what then about the argument that the use of space resources is in the public interest? And here, the case of space and deep seabed mining are very parallel. So in the case of deep seabed mining, it looked like the argument for the redistribution argument was made initially, or sort of tentatively made, but it also seems now that the justificatory narrative has shifted to the idea that deep seabed mining is environmentally beneficial. So one claim that was made is that so you might think, well, that's very puzzling, because many environmentalists are worried about deep seabed mining, and they do so with the argument that the rich metallic nodes in the seabed are near thermal vents, which are highly biodiverse and unique places, and it's unknown what the effects of deep seabed mining would be on this unique ecological space. So some people have argued, well, actually, the environmental this is just unclear to me, that the claim is that seabed mining will be less environmentally detrimental than land-based mining. But it's really unclear what the comparison is. So is it being compared to the severe environmental and social impacts of notorious mining companies, such as mining for cobalt in the Democratic Republic of Congo, or nickel mining in Indonesia, involving child labor, land conflicts, and severe deforestation, or phosphate mining in Nara, which has rendered 70% of the island uninhabitable? So is it terrestrial mining as it is actually practiced in some of the most unregulated and notorious places? Or is it the technical complexity and best practices of mining processes on land being compared with that in the seabed? I mean, I don't know, I couldn't get an answer to that. I really did look. But the main environmental case, of course, in the deep seabed and in space is not that it's environmentally safe, but that it's necessary to the green transition. And by green transition is meant the transition from greenhouse gas energy sources to the more environmentally friendly electric forms of energy, which require many of the minerals which are key to making batteries. And this is one we've talked about before. Like, this has come up numerous times here. And it is now, seems like, the main legitimating narrative. Lots of quotes about the need to ensure the growing need for renewable energy, the growing resource demands of developing countries, that if we're going to keep to the Paris Accord, we need to mine these rare earth metals, nickel, cobalt, things that are necessary for the mineral shortage. Okay, and so my last comment here is also just a worry. Like, I'm only expressing kind of worries here. One of the concerns that you might have is that this looks a little bit like greenwashing. I mean, I don't know exactly, but the argument considers only the supply side of the minerals and never the demand side, it's unclear whether it's part. So on the demand side, one study found that a combination, and I don't have the expertise to test these studies, although this was widely quoted, that a combination of recycling, technological change, and circular economy strategies, by which they mean enhanced recycling or urban mining, such as new processes, actually processes that can recover much of the lithium in electric batteries, could reduce demand for critical minerals by 58%. So the premise, the initial premise of a shortage of minerals can be questioned. And if there is not really a shortage of minerals, then it's actually not necessary to mine either space or the deep sea bed because it's necessary for the green revolution. It seems that although those metals are rare earth metals in the sense that they're rare on Earth compared to other metals, it also seems that one of the large concerns is that China, an economic and political rival of the United States, has a firm grip on supply chains for many of these metals. And so if you're suspicious of China or don't want to be vulnerable to Chinese power, then you may want to source other supply chains. But that's an international relations concern. It's not a genuine case of rarity that requires intergalactic exploration and resource management. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that in relation to a number of concerns that we might have related to resource competition and discovery in space, we might question whether the legitimating narratives for property rights in outer space, how well they actually work, whether we need to consider whether, I sort of think that we need a kind of moratorium on resource extraction at all. And some people have said that this is not imminent, but it seems to me that given the deep interconnections between national defense and private sector companies, and the questionability of these general arguments, that it's not really clear actually, that resource extraction in space is in the general interests of humanity, which I think would be necessary to show, to claim that there should be rights there. So that's really it.
Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.